From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Denver, Colorado.
Santa Maria, omnes sancti martires, sancte Ambrosi.
Crowds who couldn't reach St. Peter's Square today have assembled all over Italy and in many other countries around the world, most particularly, of course, in Krakow in Poland, where there were very moving scenes of huge crowds who gathered to watch the ceremony on giant screens, many of whom were holding their rosary beads and crying as they thought of the moments that they remember most over John Paul II's 26-year papacy.
The funeral of Pope John Paul II is underway in St. Peter's Square and one of the most momentous funerals in world history. We'll go to Rome to get a report. Then militias have stationed themselves on the Arizona-Mexico border. We'll speak with an immigrant rights activist about the Minuteman Project, as well as Salvadoran gangs being called terrorist. We'll also be joined by one of three people forcibly removed from a Social Security town hall meeting with President Bush. And we'll be joined by war surgeon Dr. Gina Strada. He's the founder of Emergency, a nonprofit humanitarian organization dedicated to providing assistance to civilian victims of war. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado. Tens of thousands of people jammed the main boulevard leading to St. Peter's Square early today to bid a final farewell to Pope John Paul II, joining kings, queens, presidents, and prime ministers for the culmination of one of the largest religious gatherings in the West in modern times. Some analysts say it's possibly the largest funeral in modern history, larger than those of India's Mohandas Gandhi, China's Mao Zedong, or Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini, each of which produced throngs in the millions. Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, dean of the College of Cardinals and a close confidant of John Paul and a possible successor, referred to him as our, quote, late beloved pope, in a homily that traced the pontiff's life from his days as a factory worker in Nazi-occupied Poland to the last days of his life as the head of the world's 1 billion Catholics. The eve of the funeral, the Vatican released the pope's last will and testament, penned in Polish over 22 years, beginning 5 months after his election in October 1978. He gave instructions for his burial and also told his private secretary to burn his personal notes upon his death. Tens of thousands of people jammed the main boulevard leading to St. Peter's Square early today to bid that final farewell to Pope John Paul II. We have this news from Iraq. Ibrahim al-Jafri has been appointed as Iraq's next interim prime minister by the country's new presidential council. Most political analysts agree that this is the most powerful position within the current political structure. Jafri said he would form a new government within 1 or 2 weeks. Officials said the previous interim prime minister, Ayad Alawi, had formally resigned. The new prime minister was appointed by the new interim president, Jalal Talabani, a Kurdish leader, and his two vice presidents shortly after they were sworn in during a ceremony in the new National Assembly in Baghdad. But the event did not go smoothly. After his inaugural speech, Talabani walked off the stage without announcing Jafri's appointment. By the time he returned to the stage and made the announcement, most television feeds of the event had already been cut off. Former UN weapons inspector Hans Blix is once again speaking out on the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. He told the Swedish news agency that he now believes oil was one of the reasons for the invasion. Blix said he initially did not believe that, but now says he thinks the U.S., quote, wanted to secure oil in case competition on the world market becomes too hard. He defended the United Nations despite recent scandals, including allegations of corruption in the Oil for Food program for Iraq. Blix called the allegations, quote, revenge from American political circles for the defeat over Iraq. A small bomb apparently stuffed with nails exploded yesterday near the heart of the main tourist bazaar in Cairo, Egypt, killing three people, including a U.S. citizen and a French woman. 18 others were reportedly wounded. The bombing occurred around 5 p.m. and was the first such attack on foreigners in Cairo in more than 7 years. Back in this country, the Food and Drug Administration has taken the painkiller Bextra off the market, and the government wants other drugs in the same class to carry the strongest possible warnings about increased risk of heart attack and stroke among the millions of people who rely on them. Consumer rights groups say the government is not doing enough to stop the distribution of what they've characterized as deadly drugs. This news from Capitol Hill. The Senate has voted to repeal President Bush's ban on international family planning organizations that engage in abortion-related activities from receiving U.S. foreign aid funds. Bush threatened to veto a 2-year, $34 billion bill authorizing State Department and foreign aid programs if it tried to override the policy that bars U.S. funds going to non-governmental organizations that give counseling or referrals on abortions or lobby against other governments' restrictive abortion laws. The polling organization Gallup reported this week that President Bush's approval rating has plunged to the lowest level of any president since World War II at this point in his second term. All other presidents who serve a second term had approval ratings well above 50% in the March following their election. Bush's current rating is 45%. The next lowest was Reagan with 56% in March 1985. The trial of 28 Italian police officers accused of beating anti-globalization demonstrators at the G8 summit 4 years ago went on trial this week in Genoa, Italy. The charges stem from a raid on the headquarters of the Genoa Social Forum that resulted in nearly 100 people injured. Among the accused are Italy's current anti-terrorism chief and the head of a European Union task force on Islamist terrorism. The charges include grievous bodily harm, slander, and false arrest. The raid came after the shooting death of activist Carlo Giuliani. Members of Brazil's landless workers movement, known as the MST, have occupied 12 farms to try to pressure the government to speed up land reform. More than 5,000 families from MST have moved on to the farms in one of Brazil's poorest states. The MST said the government had failed to live up to its election promises to have settled 400,000 families by 2007. The government says it has settled a little over a quarter of that number. The MST said the real figure is much lower. Brazil is one of the biggest wealth gaps in the world. Nearly half of all farmland is owned by just 1% of the population. The landless movement usually steps up action in April to commemorate the murders of 19 activists in 1996. The United States is refusing to extradite a group of U.S. soldiers arrested for alleged cocaine smuggling in Colombia. U.S. Ambassador William Wood says the soldiers are immune from prosecution. Colombian senators have been calling for the men who were based in the country to be handed over to Colombian authorities. More than 200 Colombian citizens have been extradited to the U.S. to face trial for drug trafficking under a bilateral deal between the two countries. Colombian politicians have asked the government to push for the U.S. to hand over the men to prove that the extradition agreement works both ways. And this news from Arizona. Three volunteers from the so-called Minutemen Project patrolling the border for undocumented immigrants are being investigated after a man told authorities he was held against his will and forced to pose for a picture holding a T-shirt with a mocking slogan. According to law enforcement officials, the 26-year-old Mexican man told agents he was physically restrained and forced to hold a shirt while his picture was taken, and he was videotaped. The shirt read, "Brian Barton caught an illegal alien, and all I got was this T-shirt."
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado. The funeral of Pope John Paul II is underway in St. Peter's Square in Rome. Up to 2 million people are watching the service on giant television screens around the city in what's being described as one of the most momentous funerals in world history. 4 kings, 5 queens, at least 70 presidents and prime ministers are attending the open-air service. Hundreds of thousands of pilgrims have poured into the Vatican to attend the ceremony. Roman Catholics around the world are following the funeral on television or attending masses in local churches. John Paul's 26-year leadership of the Roman Catholic Church was the third longest in history. He was the first non-Italian pope in over 400 years. During his papacy, he visited a record 120 nations and was seen in person by millions. After his death, the pope's body lay in state in St. Peter's Basilica for 4 days, bringing millions of pilgrims streaming through the Vatican in a vigil that almost paralyzed Rome. Today's 3-hour funeral ceremony was conducted by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, Dean of the Sacred College of Cardinals, which will begin elections, electing the pope's successor on the 18th of April. Italy closed the airspace over central Rome and called in extra forces, anti-aircraft missiles, and patrol boats to guard the funeral. Authorities ordered all public offices, schools, and museums to close and banned cars from the roads. After the funeral mass, the pope's coffin will be carried back into St. Peter's Basilica and laid to rest in a crypt after being enclosed in a zinc coffin and finally an oak casket. Just before the program, we spoke with Christian Science Monitor correspondent Sophie Arie in Rome. She described what was taking place in the Capitol.
This morning we have seen the full pomp and circumstance of what's being described as the biggest funeral in the history of the Vatican and possibly one of the biggest gatherings in one single place in world history. What we've seen is a very, very traditional ceremony, a mass and a tribute led by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the German number three under John Paul's papacy. And it was an emotional and deeply Christian ceremony. Looking on at the sides of the altar were in fact a gathering of world leaders from all religions and all races. But what we saw was effectively the evidence of the global reach of the Vatican. In between the very traditional Latin readings and chants from the Bible, we saw a string of representatives of nations around the world, from the Philippines to South America to Germany and Burkina Faso, just to give you an idea of the global reach of Catholicism. Each of these countries gave a prayer in its own language. So we've heard Portuguese, Spanish, German, every language that the Catholic world speaks. And also we saw a string of representatives of some of those countries who played a part in setting down all the relative symbolic items that play the part in a Catholic Mass, and they then were each blessed one by one by Cardinal Ratzinger. This I describe just to give you a feel of the international reach of this event. Again, in the crowd of ordinary citizens out in St. Peter's Square, we saw flags from Poland, of course, predominantly red and white flags of Poland waving above the crowd, who all were standing very still and very respectfully. It's a changing atmosphere from what we've seen in the past few days in Rome, where there's been almost a football crowd crushing into the queue to try to see the Pope's body before time ran out. Today we have a much more austere and somber mood in the crowd, which is fitting for this, obviously, very sad but very important occasion in which people are remembering John Paul II for the great role he played in 20th century history. What we have is a major, major operation on the part of the Italian officials. The only sound that we've heard, along with the gentle chanting in Latin throughout this mass this morning, has been the constant throbbing of helicopters overhead, watching out for keeping a cover of the crowds, both to control the numbers of people moving through the city, but also obviously on high alert for any possible terrorist attack in these days of the global war on terrorism. The Italian airspace has been closed today. Traffic's been banned within the whole of the city of Rome from the outer ring road inwards, meaning that the streets are empty and full of only pedestrians and pilgrims who we see walking around in a very unusual scene for Rome, where mostly what we see is very well-heeled tourists. Now we have an army of youngsters, mainly dressed in travelling clothes and carrying backpacks and sleeping bags. The other thing that's been very moving about this morning's ceremony is that we've seen that crowds who couldn't reach St. Peter's Square today have assembled all over Italy and in many other countries around the world, most particularly, of course, in Krakow in Poland, where there were very moving scenes of huge crowds who gathered to watch the ceremony on giant screens, many of whom were holding their rosary beads and crying as they thought of the moments that they remember most over John Paul II's 26-year papacy, which for Poland has greater resonance than for any other country. They feel so proud of this pope. They call him their son, but they also, many people I've spoken to, have simply paid tribute to him for putting Poland on the map in the world.
Christian Science Monitor correspondent Sophie Ari reporting from Rome. For more on the Pope, we're joined now by Italian journalist Raffaele Mastrolenardo. He joins us on the line from Rome. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Raffaele.
Hello. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. We heard the description just now of Sophie Ari describing the scene. Can you talk in Rome about the significance? Though the Pope is seen as a man of the world, he also has a particular place in Italian politics.
Oh, of course he has. I mean, what we saw today was pretty extraordinary. I mean, there were, if you look at the scene in the square, you could see many youngsters. So what this Pope did throughout this 25 years of pontificate was using any modern communication tools to, you know, reach out the youngsters. And so this is also the problem that the church is facing now, looking for a successor. Because they know that many of these young people gathering there today were there because of him, because of his, you know, great stature. Now they are facing this problem. What they are going to do afterward?
They're talking about the man who conducted the mass, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, Dean of the Sacred College of Cardinals, as a possible successor. What do you hear?
Well, I think that he is not likely to be a possible successor. He's too old, first of all, and probably considered now too conservative. Well, I think that the biggest dilemma now facing the conclave is whether they are going for a young pope, for a long pontificate, or for what they call a transition pontificate, a smaller one that doesn't innovate that much. Well, it all depends on which direction they are going to follow. I think, and many people here think, that they are going through an Italian cardinal, because, you know, Italian cardinals think that after 26 years of a foreign pope, they want an Italian pope back on the Vatican.
Bishop Desmond Tutu has been calling for a pope from Africa.
Well, Desmond Tutu has called for a pope from Africa. And actually, the Nigerian cardinal, Arenzi, he is pretty likely to get to the Vatican. According to English bookmakers, he is tied with Dionigi Tetamanzi, Milan's cardinal. He is one of the favorites. But, you know, we have a say here in Italy that if you get into the conclave as a pope, you are going out of the conclave as a cardinal. So, I mean, it's safe not to put too much faith on this, you know, speculation about the next pope, particularly if they point out to a particular figure. Because even John Paul II was not a favorite when the conclave that elected him started.
Raffaella Mastro-Leonardo, last comment before we wrap up.
Okay. Bye.
Any last thoughts?
Sorry?
Any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Okay. Hello? Sorry, it's very bad. I cannot hear you.
I'm asking if you have any last comments before we wrap up. Well, we will leave it there. Raffaella Mastro-Leonardo, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a freelance journalist speaking to us from Rome, Italy. When we return, we'll be joined by Italian doctor Gino Strada. He sets up hospitals in war-torn zones of the world. He'll be with us in our studio here in Denver. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 330 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, NPR stations, public access TV stations, as well as PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org. We're closed caption for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. Well, some might say, those who are religious, even those who aren't, that he's doing God's work. We're joined by Dr. Gino Strada. He's a war surgeon and founder of Emergency, a nonprofit humanitarian organization dedicated to providing assistance to civilian victims of war. Working in Iraq, Afghanistan, Sudan, Sierra Leone, Cambodia, Rwanda, Emergency enters war zones and provides medical assistance in conflict situations. In February, the English-language edition of Dr. Strada's memoir, Green Parrots, appeared in the United States with an introduction by Howard Zinn. Dr. Strada's campaign against the manufacture and sale of the green flying anti-personnel mines helped persuade Italy to abandon the use and manufacture of these mines. Dr. Strada joins us now in our Denver studio. Welcome to Democracy
Thank
Now!
You.
It's good to have you with us. So explain what green parrots are.
Well, the green parrots are small anti-personnel mines They look more or less like a butterfly, and they have been scattered by the thousands over the Afghan villages during the Soviet occupation. And obviously, no adults or military personnel would pick up these objects. These mines are meant to create an army of mutilated children, and in this respect, I consider them as a form of terrorism towards the civilian populations. And we have in Afghanistan a lot of children who lost their hands or who lost their eyes because of these landmines. So it has been a big, big tragedy, and it is a big tragedy for the Afghan people.
Who manufactures them?
Oh, that was manufactured in Russia. Technically speaking, it's a PFM-1, anti-personnel mines, Russian-made.
Mm-hmm. And are they all manufactured there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, these landmines were scattered basically during the year of occupation. And the problem is that they move. They are very small objects. The weight is about, you know, less than 100 grams. And therefore, even mine clearance is very difficult. So unfortunately, this is a tragedy that the Afghan people have to face for the decades to come, to have their country polluted with this kind of terrible weapons. Mm.
The landmine treaty is one that has been very controversial in this country, the president not signing off on it.
Yeah, it's a pity because, you know, in other countries, in Italy as well, for instance, the campaign was very successful. And I think that the United States should join. It's not only the United States who didn't sign the treaty, by the way. It's Russia, it's China, it's India, it's Pakistan, so very big countries. Signing a treaty will not change the situation in humanitarian terms, but will be a sort of insurance for the future generations. And I think the landmine campaign should revitalize, basically, because these weapons are really a horror.
This is the 11th anniversary of the massacre, the genocide in Rwanda. You've set up a hospital there?
Yeah, we had an operation in Rwanda during the war where we set up the... We reopened, basically, the surgical hospital, the capital city, Kigali, and the maternity hospital. The hospitals were destroyed, bombed, abandoned, full of rubbish. And it took us many, many months of work to get them back, you know, up and running. After that, we closed our operations in Rwanda at the end of 94, about roughly 6 months after the end of the hostilities.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on this 11th anniversary, what it meant that it was... that it happened, that the UN did not move to prevent it, that the U.S. didn't invoke the word genocide as it was taking place, which would trigger international mechanisms to get involved.
Well, you know, my feeling is that no one is really interested about genocides. Genocides are always invoked when there are political agendas behind. And in fact, that was a prime example. I mean, the UN did not intervene, as they did not intervene in many, many other situations. I mean, I've been working in war zones for 17 years now, and every time that the war goes into an acute phase, the UN disappear, and I don't understand why is it. I mean, they were supposed to be there and to keep peace and stability.
Mm-hmm. From Rwanda to Sudan, the UN came out with a report saying, well, they won't call it genocide, but it's a very serious situation.
Well, it is. I mean, we are in Darfur and in Khartoum. In Darfur, there's a conflict that is ongoing since 20, 25 years, a low-tension conflict. It has exploded 3 years ago because, you know, the political agenda of many that have been fueling this conflict. And I would say there's no genocide at all in Darfur. There is a big humanitarian disaster, and the problem is to act towards that humanitarian disaster.
What has to be done?
Well, basically, you know, in Darfur, the population is left without water, without electricity, without medical facilities, without food. And in fact, most of the people escape for that reason. Now there are about 2 million people living in slums outside Khartoum. Some of them came because of the war with the South, but a good amount of these people arrived from the north, escaping from the area of northern Darfur and western Darfur states.
When you come to this country, you see very little coverage of areas, countries like Sudan. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, my thought is always the same, that it looks like media are not very much interested in human tragedies. They are interested only when there are plans. You know, all this business of genocide in Sudan, for instance, I think has come up as an idea to sort of pave the ground for a possible military intervention. And next door, there is the Federal Republic, Democratic Republic of Congo, where 4 million people have died because of the conflict, and no one has ever thought about mentioning genocide. So I think that, you know, we should try to get media attention to the real problems. Humanitarian problems cannot be, you know, submitted to politics, basically, and this is what happens regularly. You know, a country comes to the light of, you know, the media when there are some political agendas from very powerful nations behind it. Think about Afghanistan. Who speaks about Afghanistan now?
What should we understand about Afghanistan?
Well, that the situation is still a tragic situation, that 10,000 Afghan civilians have been killed, that there was no liberation or no democracy in Afghanistan. The Afghan population still lives in the same misery, in the same disasters. Kabul is not Afghanistan. I mean, outside Kabul, you have the same situation it was 5 years ago, basically.
What are people suffering from?
People are suffering from the fact that, you know, that country is still now, I mean, is a country where 70% of the population has never seen a doctor or a nurse in their lives. It's a country where there is no safe water. It's a country where there is malnutrition. But on top of it, it's a country that after this last aggression of 2001, 2002, has seen problems never experienced before. Prostitution, AIDS. AIDS was an unknown phenomenon, as prostitution was in Afghanistan. And now in Kabul, you have prostitutes, and health authorities start to be concerned with a possible spread of HIV in the country, which would be a tremendous tragedy in a country without medical infrastructure, without possibility to look after patients.
We're talking to Dr. Gina Strada, who has written his memoir, Green Parrots, A War Surgeon's Diary, has set up hospitals throughout the world, Iraq, today.
Well, in Iraq, you know, we started to work in 1995. We have 2 surgical centers, 1 rehabilitation center, and 22 clinics. A third hospital is under construction in the holy city of Karbala, but the problem is at the moment the security there. I mean, Karbala occasionally becomes a battlefield, and therefore the daily workers didn't feel confident to continue working. I hope I can go back to Iraq soon and see that project can continue, because that hospital is very much needed by the population. I mean, Iraq is a devastated country, first by the first Gulf War, then by the sanctions, and then by this new aggression. So there's a lot of things to be done.
Mm-hmm. We also hear very little about this in the United States. What actually is the picture on the ground in Iraq?
Well, even in Europe, I would say, I mean, there has been very, very few reports. The massacre of Fallujah, for instance, was unbelievable, and very little has been documented, and very little has been said. I think that, you know, now, unfortunately, most media are just linked to the militaries, and that's the problem. The embedded journalists for sure will not report what they see in the ground. They will report only when they're, what they are told to explain to the public. And this doesn't include civilian casualties. I mean, the 100,000 civilian Iraqis who have been killed in this past 2 years are something that would have deserved much more media attention worldwide, I think.
Why did you get into war medicine?
Well, by chance, you know, I wanted to see how the job of a surgeon would look like in a third world country, and I ended up in a hospital on the Pakistani-Afghani border that was back in 1987, 1988. And you see that, you know, 90% of the victims are civilians, 1/3 of them are children, no medical facilities available. So it was easy to say, I mean, okay, something can be done, and let's put together an organization to help these victims. And in fact, I'm very happy in a way that emergency has grown up big, in the sense that we were able in these 10 years to look after 1.4 million victims of war, which is still a drop in the bucket compared to the magnitude of the tragedy, but it's good.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Gina Strada, for joining us. Dr. Gina Strada, a war surgeon, founder of Emergency, a nonprofit humanitarian organization dedicated to assisting civilian victims of war. Gina Strada's book is called Green Parrots, A War Surgeon's Diary. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we turn now to this country, to an issue that some might consider a health issue, it is Social Security. As President Bush continues touring the country to promote his plans for overhauling Social Security, some have begun to ask questions about the costs and the procedures determining who is permitted to attend these publicly funded events. Yesterday, an article in the Washington Post reported that this tour may be one of the most expensive in memory, costing millions of taxpayer dollars. Congressmember Henry Waxman, the ranking Democrat on the Government Reform Committee, wrote a letter to the Government Accountability Office asking for the exact cost of the tour and questioned whether the administration had crossed the line from education to propaganda. Waxman's letter stated in part, quote, "There's a vital line between informing the public, as the president did in his State of the Union address, and commandeering vast resources of the federal government to fund a political campaign for Social Security privatization." Another member of Congress, Diana DeJet, has requested that the House Government Reform Committee investigate the exclusion procedures at these events. In North Dakota and Arizona, people expressing contrary political views were denied access to the Bush events. The latest incident happened on March 21st here in Denver, where three Coloradans were ejected from President Bush's Social Security town hall meeting. Here with us in our studio is one of those people kicked out, Alexander Young. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Tell us what happened.
Well, on Monday, March 21st, at an event billed as a conversation on saving Social Security, I and two friends, Leslie Weiss and Karen Bauer, decided to go down and participate in this dialogue. Unfortunately, we were evicted before the president arrived by an as-yet-unnamed man because of the content on the bumper sticker of my friend's car. That bumper sticker said, "No more blood for oil."
And so you went from the car, what, a parking lot?
Right. We parked in the parking lot, stood in line for a half an hour or so, went and sat down in the audience, and then were forcibly ejected by a person who was posing as a Secret Service agent.
Why did you think he was a Secret Service agent?
Previous to our entry, he had pulled aside a couple of friends of mine. Leslie and Karen were pulled aside and were told to wait for the Secret Service to arrive. And this man appeared and started threatening them, telling them that they would be sent to prison and arrested if they pulled anything while they were inside.
And then?
And then this is the same individual who came and grabbed us from the audience and started pushing and shoving us out of the hall.
On what grounds? Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't say. We kept asking, "Why are you doing this? Who are you? Where are we going?" And he wouldn't answer any of those questions. This man was wearing a wire. He had one of those earpiece microphones on, and he had a lapel pin similar to a Secret Service agent wearing a navy blue suit.
So now, at the time, you definitely thought he was Secret Service.
Definitely.
What about now?
Well, the Secret Service has informed us that he was not an agent, that he was, in fact, a host committee person. So we believe that that is in stark contrast to the White House's official description of him being a volunteer.
Explain.
Scott McClellan answered three questions about this about a week ago. He said that this person was a volunteer and that this was an anomalous event. We think that this event is quite like other events that have happened around the country, like in Fargo, North Dakota, and in Oregon, where people have been evicted because of political speech. And we find that to be really, really atrocious. It's an abuse of taxpayer funds to have events that are posed as public events, but at the same time, they're really very private events to a select crowd so that the president can pitch his message to the public.
Did anyone protest when you were being taken out to say, "Don't move them out"?
No, no one protested, but we did have other people in the audience who saw what happened, and they're definitely appalled by it as we are.
How did you get in? Did you have tickets?
We had tickets from Republican Congressman Bob Beaupre's office. I just went to Bob Beaupre's office and asked for a ticket.
And what has Congressman Beaupre said about this?
Beaupre has said that he's also appalled by this and that he thinks that we are justified in taking action.
What are you going to do?
First of all, we're trying to identify this person who did evict us, find out who is behind this, what his name is, and what his employers are. We want to make sure this doesn't happen again in America. We find this very, very appalling.
Who are you meeting with to find out who he is?
We've asked our congressional delegation to open investigations. As you said earlier, Diana DeGette has asked for congressional investigations. Senator Ken Salazar has asked Denver District Attorney Mitch Morsi to investigate allegations that this person posed as a law enforcement officer, which is a crime in Colorado and federally. We're just trying to find out, first of all, who this person is, and secondly, make sure this doesn't happen again. It's wrong.
Why did you go to this meeting, Alex, this town hall meeting of the president?
I and my friends, we have some differing viewpoints on Social Security, and I, for one, think that the president's plan is a bad one, and I think that if he's having conversations in America, then we need to have all voices at the table. We need to have dissenting opinions on these programs.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Our guest has been Alex Young, who is one of three people who were forcibly removed from President Bush's town hall conversation on Social Security, as it's billed, that took place here in Denver on March 21st.
Thank you, Amy.
This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the Minuteman Project on the border. We'll talk with an immigrant rights activist about that, as well as the increasing discussion, especially on the cable networks, equating a Salvadoran gang with Al-Qaeda. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from Denver, Colorado. I'm Amy Goodman. Three volunteers from the so-called Minuteman Project, patrolling the Arizona border for undocumented immigrants, are being investigated after a man told authorities he was held against his will and forced to pose for a picture holding a T-shirt with a mocking slogan. According to law enforcement officials, the 26-year-old Mexican man told agents he was physically restrained and forced to hold a shirt while his picture was taken. He was videotaped. The shirt read, quote, "Brian Barton caught an illegal alien and all I got was this T-shirt." We're joined in our studio right now by Magdaleno Rose Avila. He is the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project based in Seattle. He's come to Denver, Boulder, University of Colorado, Boulder, for the week-long conference that is culminating today, the week-long conference called Conference on World Affairs. We welcome you to Democracy
Thank
Now!
You.
Then you head off to an Amnesty International conference on immigration
Austin,
in Austin today.
Austin, Texas, yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us on the way to the airport. Talk about the Minuteman Project. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's kind of incredible that American citizens could go to the border, many of them armed, and intervene in what is a legal process between the Border Patrol and undocumented immigrants that are coming here. This case with this Mr. Barton and his friends doing this, this is ludicrous. They should never have been allowed to detain this man. That was against the regulations, against what they said they were going to do. But it's part of an inflamed environment, almost racist against immigrants, that they think that they're at the border to stop undocumented workers, Al-Qaeda, and who knows what else, by sitting in their campers. They're stopping this individual is just a preview of worse things that could happen.
What do you think has to be done?
I think they should get them out of there right away. Second is I think we need to educate people about the immigrant issue and what their issues really are and why this country is dependent on immigrants, why we couldn't live without them, and how we must have immigration reform in order to deal with the problem. But right now, having U.S. citizens who think they're doing right but are doing wrong is going to cause more problems than it's going to help any issue. We call it the clash of the undocumented. Undocumented immigrants and undocumented Border Patrol agents.
Why do you think immigrants are so important in this country?
Well, we have a history. Our history is immigrants. There are many jobs in this country that American workers don't want to take. The economies around the world where we have invested monies and put maquiladoras and everything that haven't functioned well, those countries whose economics are in ruin or the politics are ruined, they come to this country to work. If you took all the immigrants away from who are undocumented across the United States, crops wouldn't be harvested, restaurants would close, car washes would close, people would lose their nannies, their gardeners. It's part of the economic system of America. To deny that is wrong. Even Senator McCain has said, we need immigrant workers.
Can you talk about the media's role in this?
Well, I think the media and some politicians, including Tom Tancredo here of Colorado, have gone off the deep end because they're starting to say that the immigrants are the problems for America right now. And some of them, including CNN's Lou Dobbs and Fox News in particular, have been out beating the drum against the immigrants, blaming the immigrants for everything and not having a factual a news-based program where you can present both sides. They blame the immigrants without having a defense of the immigrants. And they're trying to tell us, just like when we had Pete Wilson in 187, that the immigrants were the problems for the economics of California. And it's wrong. And right now they're trying to say, because of Homeland Security, that the immigrants may be bringing weapons of mass destruction, may be bringing other things across the border. And President Fox has said there is no Al-Qaeda in Mexico.
Well, what about this issue of Al-Qaeda, and particularly somehow linking Al-Qaeda with a Salvadoran gang? Can you talk about it? You've spent many years in Salvador working with gangs.
Right, and I was the founder of Homies Unidos that continues to work with gangs in El Salvador and Los Angeles, both with what they call MS-13, La Mara Salvatrucha, Calle 18, 18th Street. And to say, you know, gangs are an issue. They're a phenomenon that was created by the wars in Central America and people fleeing up here. That's what created them, and then we deported them, and they started gangs in Central America. But to think that Al-Qaeda would get the most identifiable group of immigrants and ask them to bring rocket launchers and weapons of mass destruction, you know, I can just see a bunch of homies, you know, homeboys and homegirls saying, orale, do you have your rocket launcher? Let's bring it across the border with their baggy pants, their tattoos, shaved heads. It's not happening. That is a shell game that they're doing. They arrested 103 gang members in this country to say they're doing something about terrorists. They couldn't find the weapons of mass destruction. That's a lie. They'll never find gang members associated with Al-Qaeda. That's a lie, and it should stop today.
Can you talk about the gangs? Who are they?
Well, the gangs are youth that came to this country with their parents when they were small children in order to survive while their parents were working two or three jobs. School systems couldn't handle Salvadorians, Guatemalans, Hondurans, so they went to the streets. They had to join gangs to survive. They go back to when they're deported to their countries and they start to survive. And they set up a network, sort of like an alternate society. Society won't fit them in, then they create the gangs. Most gang members, when we surveyed them in 1996, said they would prefer to get a job, get an education, and leave violence. But unless society responds, both on this side of the border and in Latin America, we will not be able to resolve the issue. The issue is if we don't take care of youth, they're going to join an alternate society. We knew that from the 60s, and we know that from the gang culture. They're youth who have lost an opportunity to become an integral part of society. And yes, there's violence in there. Yes, there's some drugs. But you know, when you look around violence in the United States, Central America, and drugs, there's more drugs and violence outside of the gangs than inside of the gangs. And gang members can change. I know that.
MS-13, how did they get their name?
Mara Salvatrucha.
Which means?
Mara is a word they use in El Salvador for a gathering. So if me, you, and another person were a Mara, a group of people. But now they use it for gangs. Salva means like to save, or from Salvador, the name of the country. And Trucha means that you got it all together, you're cool. So La Mara Salvatrucha was a response to 18th Street. So that originally it was all Salvadorians. Now they have everything. There's Koreans in there in L.A. There's African-Americans. There's Anglos in Mara Salvatrucha. And 13, for those who don't know, and you know the State Department doesn't know this, we sort of divide California, Norteños and Sureños. Sureños meaning southern gang members, and 13 represent means you're from the southern part of the state.
And the tattoos on the faces?
Well, the tattoos is the way you, you know, everybody, not everybody can publish a book and talk about their history. So one is you do the tattoos to create your own history. If you look at a gang member's tattoos across their body, across their face, first thing they put is the tattoo of their gang so that they say, I'm proud of being who I am. Then if you look down their chest or their arms, you begin to see when they were incarcerated, when they lost their favorite friend, when their mother died, their father died, because nobody else is recording their history. That's what the tattoos are a living history for gang members. And I can tell you, from working with Mara Salvatrucha in El Salvador, in L.A., in Calle 18, 18th Street, these people want a chance to have a better life. And I think in America, it can give it to them.
We're talking to Magdalena Rosavilla, who is the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Right Project. Now, that's based in Seattle. You're in Los Angeles. You worked in Salvador. Why'd you go to Seattle?
Seattle, because it was an opportunity for me to enter the immigration debate. And I had been involved in immigration in 1974 when we started immigration work out of Los Angeles with Casa and Bert Corona in the early days. And I saw Northwest Immigrant Rights as one of the leading voices in behalf of immigrants, progressive immigrant policies. And I saw this as the premier issue 3 years ago. And a year and a half ago, I was able to go and work. And I think that I was right. This is a debate that we have to have, an issue that we have to struggle with at this point in our history.
You mentioned Homeland Security. Homeland Security contracts out a for-profit prison in Tacoma, Washington.
Right.
Who's being put in these detention facilities?
Primarily undocumented immigrants, but people from all over. And what they're trying to do is we've set up all these detention centers. We have a detention center that right now is housing 500. It'll go up to 1,000 pretty soon. And what they're doing is they're doing all these roundups of brown people. And they start first with the Muslims, the Sikhs, then go to the Latinos. You round them up and you put them in, and then you say, we're making America safer because we got rid of all of your dishwashers, all of your field workers. And the employers are getting a little bit angry. And it really isn't resolving the issue. As long as there's disparity, people are going to come here. But right now is what we're doing, because we are on a fast track. Arrest people, get them out before we can get them an attorney. People do not have a defense. So many people are being deported today who have a right to be here. We have two cases that we documented where U.S. citizens have been deported. And that's wrong.
Who?
Well, I don't remember the names, but we have the cases in the office. But we have one guy who's still in Mexico to resolve his issue, and another guy who was deported and just came back. And it wouldn't be fair to them to give their names out in a public forum till we resolve their immigration case.
Somalis are also a target in Seattle. How are the different ethnic groups, different groups of people from different countries working together on this issue?
Well, Northwest Immigrant Rights with Hate-Free Zone, Amnistia, Pro-Amnistia.
What is Hate-Free Zone?
Hate-Free Zone is an organization that grew out of 9/11, run by a wonderful woman, Pramila Jayapal. And they grew out of the response to defend the Sikhs and the Muslims, the Somalis, everyone who's being targeted by the government and by hate crimes, and they started working on it. Right now, unfortunately, we're having a number of Somalis across the country being sent back to Somalia, to a place normally we don't send people back when a government doesn't exist. Somalia doesn't have a functioning government. But this government, because we've targeted Islamic people, we're going to send them back en masse to that country because their documents are not in order.
When I met you last night, Leno, you were talking about talking with the authorities about who they round up. Can you share that story?
Well, yeah, because, you know, every time that we would see them, that they would round up people of color. And in the state of Washington, California, Arizona, it was mostly Latinos. So I asked them, you know, why weren't they rounding up in our part of the world some of the Eastern Europeans, the Russians, and in particular the Canadians who were undocumented? They said, we can't identify them. So I said, well, just go to downtown Seattle and hang around where the Anglo-looking people are. And when they, in their language, say something like, how are you doing, A, which the Canadians do, then arrest those people and arrest everyone around them till they can prove they have proper documents. They said, no, that's racial profiling. And I said, well, what are you doing to us? Just because we're brown, and we have cases all over the country where immigration stops you just because you have a dark skin, and that's wrong.
Do you think that there's any light at the end of the tunnel?
Yes, I do. Because of programs like this and people who are having forums to talk about immigrant rights and human rights, people should remember, just as in Germany, if you're silent when they attacked you, there's going to be nobody to defend you when your turn comes around. And right now they're attacking gang members and immigrants, and you know what? You're going to be next. And the people have to become educated about immigration, the Patriot Act, and I think people are doing that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Magdaleno Rosavilla. We were just in Seattle, but today here we are in Denver, Colorado, as you head out to Austin for an Amnesty conference. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Magdaleno Rosavilla is executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project in Seattle. As we wrap up right now, we continue our Unembed the Media tour. Today in Boulder, University of Colorado Boulder, the Mackey Auditorium at noon, a major address. And then tonight and Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Central Presbyterian Church in Denver, a KGNU benefit. We'll be talking about the Bush victory in November. Chip Berlay will be one of those who will be speaking. Tomorrow on Saturday, we'll be in Omaha, Nebraska at 1 o'clock in the evening in Lincoln, Nebraska. On Monday, we'll be in Salt Lake City, Sunday night in E-Town in Boulder. Then we'll be going to Ogden, Utah on Tuesday, back in New York at Cooper Union on Wednesday with Tariq Ali and others. And then we're headed to Los Angeles. We continue the tour. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to get more information. Our production, Democracy Now!, is done by a remarkable team of people: Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Again, if you'd like to sign up for our Daily Digest email list or see the latest on our Exception to the Rulers Unembed the Media tour, go to our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!